Good morning and welcome to St. Paul's Bible Study. Today we are going to be working on the Gospel of Thomas. We're still working on it. I invite your patience as people come into the room and we get started. Good morning, Grace.
Good morning.
How are you doing today?
I'm meaning to ask you how your sister's going.
Oh, she's very well, thank you. She's doing well.
That's good news.
Yeah. Okay. Marilyn, are you with us?
Morning, Marilyn.
Hi.
How are you doing, Marilyn?
Oh, just great. Thank you.
Good. Move that over here. I don't know if that will help. Okay. So we are looking at, let's see, where are we? Aha. Saying number 15 is where we are beginning today.
Where is everybody?
I don't know.
It's a doozy, I tell you.
Yeah. Jeanette mentioned in email that she was not feeling well, and so she would be missing today. I don't know where everybody else is.
Okay.
Well, let me just go ahead and read saying 15, and we'll begin. Yeshua said, "When you see someone who was not born from a womb, then prostrate yourselves, and give worship, for this is your father." Let's let that sink in with a little bit of silence, and then we'll begin our discussion. All right, what do you guys think about this one? Grace, it's a doozy?
Yeah, it is. I was trying to read through it, and one of the things I read, it says that the one who was born from the womb of God. Mm-hmm. So is that what they're referring to with you were not born a woman?
You know,
from the womb of God.
It's possible. It's very possible. I tend to think of it in a slightly different way, but that doesn't make my view of it better than the one you just put out. So the way
I
think
you recognize a person like that, though.
That's a fair question, Marilyn. So the way I think about it is less, okay, how do you recognize a person like that? Or kind of scrutinizing everyone. Is that an angel? Is that an angel? Is that God? You know, not so much doing that. Hold on. Did it work? Okay, sorry. I'm using the church's laptop and it is a little squirrely sometimes. So anyway, looking at Logion 15, the thing that I think about here is there is no human being on earth who deserves to be put on a pedestal the way we put people on pedestals and the way we put God on a pedestal. And I don't know if you've noticed, but humans tend to do this. If we really like a person, we put them up on a pedestal. And if we really hate a person, we call them evil. And we tend to make the people outside of us either into godlike figures on the one hand, or Satan-like figures on the other. And I feel like what saying 15 is trying to tell us, perhaps, is no, they're all just human. And no one deserves your worship but God. Not your favorite politician does not deserve your worship. Not your favorite movie star, not your pastor, not your father, not your mother. No one deserves worship but God. And you can see the inverse inside of that. No one deserves to be demonized by anyone. And it doesn't matter if they do things you don't like. Tough. That's life. You still have no right to demonize them. It's possible that I take this view of saying 15 because it's easier to understand. I recognize that that might be the case here. Because otherwise I'd have to be like squinting at everyone who goes by and think, were they born of a woman? I don't know. Could I ask? Probably not. That would be rude. Hey, Sue, welcome to the party.
Good morning.
Morning, Sue.
Good morning. It's good to see you and it's good to be with you.
Well, I like that explanation. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, we're on saying 15, which is short and crazy.
I was going to say short and confusing.
So, Grace, what do you think about the alternate explanation? Does it make sense? Do you not like it? Grace?
No, I found it, I find it maybe not true. Is it just an idea, not fact?
No, it's just my idea. You don't have to agree with it. That's the fun part. you don't have to agree with it. And so, you know, if you want to go through the world and think, well, actually, I think that person is evil. And actually, I think that person is an angel put on earth or someone who is like God, then you can do that. I'm not saying you can't. Sue, did you catch enough of the conversation to get the gist?
I caught the last part of the fact of the opposite also being the case, which is what I think you're talking about. I would think that you could think that a person, you know, you could have the sense that someone is just evil by what's going on. But to judge the person is evil. I mean, I can think or feel something, but I have no business judging and proclaiming that they are evil, and especially publicly. But but it seems to me that there is perhaps, and I don't know this, but perhaps a fine line between thinking and judging. I suspect it would be a very fine line.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is also, the saying itself is in the positive, not in the negative. And so I was inferring the negative.
Right.
But the saying is, my interpretation of the saying is that you shouldn't be looking at anyone in the world and saying that person is God or that person is like God. And so I'm going to put them up on a pedestal and worship them. Not anyone that you love, not anyone that you revere, not a politician you love and respect, not a pastor you love and respect, not your parents. Like, none of those people are God. And so none of those people should be worshiped. And I'm reminded that, you know, Jesus was wandering around in Roman controlled Palestine, and the emperor was God. It was a theocracy, among other things. And so you absolutely, if you were a Roman citizen, it was understood that the emperor was one of the gods that you honored, and that the emperor was a son of God and God. And so with that in mind, saying the emperor was born of a woman, born from a womb, so don't worship the emperor. And a little bit before Jesus was born, the Maccabean revolt happened in Jerusalem and in that area because someone put up the desolating sacrilege in the middle of the Jewish temple. And the desolating sacrilege was a Gigunda statue of Zeus. So imagine that. Riddle me that, Batman. Imagine putting a giant statue in the middle of, imagine putting a giant statue of, oh, I don't know, Osiris in the middle of Chartres Cathedral, and then telling everybody to bow down and worship to it. It's a little bit what it would be like.
I have a lot less trouble going along with the don't refer to anybody as God than I do with the evil part.
Okay. That's fair.
Another thing, and it's probably just a simply a matter of translation, but I just noticed that it says, your faith, worship him.
Mm-hmm.
They probably didn't have, did they even have terms for her and him in their language at that time or when this was?
Yeah. I mean, this would have been in Coptic. And yeah, they had male and female in Coptic. And they have male and female in, I'm blanking on it. It's a dialect of Hebrew that Jesus and his followers spoke. And I apologize, I'm blanking on it. But yeah, they've got male and female.
It still doesn't bother me as much as non-part, you know. But,
right. All right. Well, if that's all we've got to say about saying 15, let's move on to saying 16. Marilyn, do you want to read it from your version?
Okay. Jesus said, is that the right one?
Yes. Well, most of them begin that way.
It says it's 16 here, so okay. Jesus said, men think perhaps that it is peace which I have come to cast upon the world. They do not know that it is divisions which I have come to cast upon the earth, fire, sword, and war. For there will be five in a house, three will be against two, and two against three, the father against the son, and the son against the father, and they will stand up, being one alone.
Thank you, Marilyn. Let's let that sink in a moment of silence. What do you make of saying 16?
Another confusing one.
Anyone have any thoughts about it?
I find it interesting that Jesus would say that he is, and I've heard it, you know, many times, of course, but that he has come to create divisions when his goal for his church is that they all be one. Mm-hmm. So it leads you to believe that unity is good, division is bad, and why would he want to create division?
Right. Sue, what were you going to say?
Well, we must still be under that impression that he came to bring peace to the world, because all our Christmas cards say so.
They do, don't they?
And that celebrates his birthday.
Mm-hmm.
So at his birth, it was joy and peace to the world, and we sing that to this day.
And he said, "My peace I leave unto you," or something like that.
Yes, that's in the Gospel of John.
But that we would not, that we are not capable of understanding his peace. That I can't remember how those words go, but something to the point that it's beyond our comprehension. His peace is beyond our comprehension.
It probably depends a lot on what the definition of peace is when he's using it.
Well, one of the things that I think about when I wrestle with this passage, which I have wrestled with before, is what does he mean by it? And what do we mean by it? And when I think about that, I'm thinking, you know, what does he mean by peace? What do we mean by peace? What does he mean by sowing division, fire, sword, war? And then he gives an example of what that will be like, you know, in a household. I realize that, and I see this a lot in my preaching. You know, I can say something and people can come out of it, out of that sermon moment, believing that I said exactly opposite things. I don't know if you've encountered this when you've had conversations with people where you find out later that they actually took the exact opposite of what you meant. And they took that away, and that's what they thought you said, when you were desperately trying to say the other thing. But I get this a lot with preaching, which might be a commentary on my preaching, who knows. But the idea of peace, okay, even when I think about peace in political terms, and I'm looking at like big picture geopolitical peace, some people look at peace and think peace is for wusses, peace is for the weak, peace is getting walked over. Okay, some people look at peace, big picture geopolitical peace, and think peace is stability. Peace is prosperity for everyone. Peace is no one dying in battle. Peace is us being able to have disagreements without attacking each other, and to be able to sort out our disagreements without anyone dying. Peace is good. Peace is not bad. But if you look on the big picture geopolitical level, and if you can take yourself out of the picture just a little bit so it's not so emotionally fraught, we can definitely see that there are at least two different camps of people, and they define peace in opposite ways. And in one camp, peace is weakness, and peace is getting steamrolled over by the stronger person. And in the other camp, peace is strength. Peace is prosperity for everyone. There's no steamrolling. Okay.
It's making its choice. Which way do you want to look at it?
Right. And so then when you bring it back down to the personal level, sometimes when I talk about peace and love in a sermon, people will walk away thinking that I mean to say that someone who embraces peace and love in their life is not allowed to stand up for themselves, needs to be a doormat to everyone around them, needs to be a pushover, and that it's an excuse and permission to abuse that person and to let that person stay in abusive relationships, all in the name of peace and love. And that is, of course, not what I am trying to preach. And when I think about it that way, I think, you know, peace and love isn't the figure of a sweet little grandma knitting and letting people push her around. It isn't the figure of an idealistic teenager trying to overthrow a system they don't fully understand and can't fully replace with something better. The vision of peace and love that I'm trying to put forward in my preaching is this idea that every single one of us as individuals, and myself included, we have to stand up for ourselves in our lives to be the healthiest, most compassionate person we can. And sometimes that means pushing people away, because some of us have had trauma in our lives. For some of us, we have in our orbit abusers who would like to continue to take advantage of us. And I do not mean to say that if you're going to embrace, you know, the way of love that Jesus talks about, that you need to let people abuse you or open yourself up to more or greater or continuing trauma. And there are moments where I feel very deeply, to be the most loving person you can to someone who is abusing you, that might look like fire, sword, and war in your family life. If it is a family member who is abusing you or taking advantage of you. And that can be the hardest place of internal war you ever experience in your life, especially if it's a parent who has abused a child. And we all know, even if it's never touched our own lives, even if we don't know anyone personally who's had their parent abuse them, we know it happens. We know it's a thing. Yes, parents do sometimes abuse their children. And what therapists and the whole helping profession is coming to understand is that abused children, when they grow up and become adults, they have whole heaps of difficult issues to overcome because abuse was normal for them when they were little. And when we're little, that's when we're growing and developing a sense of what is normal in the world. Okay. So when I look at this, I don't necessarily think that Jesus is at the front of the army and he's just going to decimate the world. What I think is that Jesus is trying to lead us, sometimes kicking and screaming, into greater places of love and compassion and health. Because I think that the health is the sort of loving yourself to the greatest degree that you can. Pardon me, I will silence my phone. I think health is loving yourself utterly and completely. And so being able to do that sometimes means cutting off, like with a sword, a relationship that is slowly killing you inside. And we know that relationships can do that. And that's where my brain goes. That's what I think of when I think of this, especially if there are five in a house and then there's three against two and two against three. Because just because I may understand, okay, this is a terrible relationship, this is bad for me, this, I can't become the beautiful child of God that God wants me to be, doesn't mean that other people very close to me might see the same thing. Not everybody is always on board with that.
And I think people...
Go on.
Excuse me, but hearing like sight is very often people see or hear what they need to see or hear at the moment. And yep. It's very real for them. It's not something imagined. It's they take what they need.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you guys think about this sort of interpretation? Sue?
In today's pandemic mode, I have seen close up families split just like this little saying says, over to mask or not to mask, to vaccine or not to vaccine. And I have seen it blow up at a dinner table and destroy an otherwise joyful occasion. And so that's not so far-fetched. Not then, at the time when Jesus was teaching about taking the rules so seriously, you forget the purpose, you forget the inside of yourself part of it. And here we are 2,000 years later, and we're having this similar kinds of arguments over health laws.
Oh. Oh.
So blessed is the peacemaker.
Yeah.
If it's possible.
It's all about choices, about which way you think is right and which you think is wrong. It's all about what choice you want to make.
Mm-hmm. That is always true, Grace. Yeah. Yeah. And just glancing at the commentary here, it I really appreciate that the it talks about the peace of Christ and what does it look like? What does it mean? And that essentially it is not, the peace of Christ is not meant to be an opiate. And the peace of Christ is not meant to, for you to imagine that your life will never have difficulties ever again, which, you know, I just think is really funny. Because I recently had a conversation with someone who was about my age, but only recently ordained, and just had their first experience a couple of years as a priest in a parish. It was a rough experience and it didn't go well. And she's, you know, come out of that and she's healing now. And she was really confused because she really thought somehow, and this is a deep and spiritual woman, I don't know where she left her brain, that well, everything was going to be okay with ordination. That somehow when she got ordained to the priesthood, everything was going to be easier. And I just laughed because that's like saying, well, when I graduate, everything will be easier. Or when I get married, everything will be easier. Or when I move to this place, everything will be easier. Or when my children just leave the house, finally, everything will be easier. And it's not that these milestones don't make a change. They absolutely do. But none of them are the silver bullet to take all of the stress and strain away from our lives. And most of them just add complications. I mean, maybe not the kids leaving the house. Maybe that is, in fact, a massive relief, especially if they don't come back again for a bit. But there's no one turning point of our lives that makes the anguish go away, that happens within us, that's not an external event.
Mm-hmm. And another thing is that we need to, I think, learn to feel that we are correct in our thinking without somebody else being entirely wrong. I mean, probably they are, but still, you have to account for that. They, you know, they probably are not.
Right, right.
Entirely.
I don't know if y'all ever followed the Peanuts cartoon with Charlie Brown and Snoopy. But every now and then, Snoopy would start up with a typewriter on the top of his doghouse, and he'd be writing the great American novel. And at one point he wrote a theological manuscript, and he entitled it, "Have you ever considered you might be wrong?" And I really appreciate that. Because, you know, I could be wrong. You could be wrong. We could all be wrong. We could be right. We could be a little bit right and a little bit wrong at the same time.
This discussion on this peace issue, and you mentioned the commentary. I caught the sentence in the commentary, second sentence, I think. It is the essential piece of being which does not depend on favorable outer circumstances. Back in, I think it was 14, saying 14, it was at the end of it about being with a capital B. And I don't remember that we discussed that much. Maybe we did, and it just kind of floated through. But the essential piece of being, is that learning to be at peace with whatever you're living with? I mean, that then leads you to that abusive back and forth.
Right.
And yet there's a sense of contentment.
Mm-hmm.
In life, if you're lucky.
Well, let me address that. I think the peace that passes all understanding that is mentioned more than once in the New Testament is the peace that doesn't make sense given your circumstances. And so it explains, in a way, you know, the presence of God and the Spirit in our lives explains how people can be calm and peaceful when they've just lost their home. It explains how people can be calm and peaceful in the midst of tragedy and war. Now, just because we aim for the peace that passes all understanding, does that mean that we want to live in a war zone? No. Does that mean that we want to continue to be abused? No. Do we want to support abusers in abusing people? Support warlords in creating war on other people? No. But when these things happen, we can strive to find peace even as we make changes. And making those changes, especially as it becomes a more and more personal issue and less of a kind of geopolitical large scale issue, making those changes can be the hardest work we ever do. I mean, they say that for in a domestic violence situation, it takes, if it's a woman who's being abused, it takes a woman years to be able to have the strength and commitment to break away from the abuser. And that she may attempt to do it several times and then go back. And someone who's not in an abusive relationship might be like, why? For the love of Jesus, why? Why are you staying there? You deserve better. But it's so hard. And that's what the women who have broken away report. that it's the hardest thing they ever did in their life to break away from that situation. And we may not get it, but we can listen when they say, it was the hardest thing I ever did.
My definition of happiness for a long time, and maybe today too, is being having contentment without complacency.
Oh, I like that. That's nice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very nice. I had a teacher once who said, you know, it's really easy to be happy when people are giving you chocolate, sending you flowers, and writing you checks. And those were his three go-tos. It's easy to be happy when people are giving you chocolate, sending you flowers, and writing you checks. The measure of your sort of groundedness as a person, the measure of your contentment, is not how content you are when people are giving you chocolate, sending you flowers, and writing you checks. It's how you are in the rest of life. When no one is writing you a check and no one is sending you flowers and you haven't been given chocolate in months.
Learn to be content with what you have in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, and even as I think about that, it's, you know, I grew up in a middle income household in the suburbs in Williamsville, which y'all will recognize. And by no means was I poor. Oh, but I had some years of poverty after that. And I gotta be honest with you, it's a whole lot easier to be content with what I've got when I actually have enough money to pay all of my bills. Yes. When that sort of basic level has been met. And when that basic level hasn't been met, and literally I have needs that I can't meet, I could still have moments of peace. But it was in the midst of incredible anxiety. And that's what I think of too, when people are in major crisis or, you know, now in war zones. I want to agree with you, Grace. I want to say it's about being content with what you have. But I say that having a lot and having security and having, golly, now I have discretionary income, which is really exciting. I can actually save and buy coffee. And having, knowing that I can drive from my home to this office without worrying about a checkpoint, without worrying about a missile, without worrying that the office might not be here when I get here, without worrying about a gunman coming in, that I've just got that basic sense of safety. And I'd hate to look at someone who doesn't have that basic sense of safety and say, well, you should be content with what you've got, you know? And so it's tricky. In these situations, I think I'd only want to speak for myself. I want to be content with what I have.
But if you're having that issue, not being content, wouldn't you turn to God and ask him to help you?
Yeah. Haven't your prayers ever gone unanswered, Grace? I mean, is that just me?
No.
You know, and perhaps I'll realize later, oh, well, you know, I prayed and prayed and prayed and the answer was already there. God had given me the answer long ago and I wasn't listening, or it just took more time than I wanted to be able to change my situation.
The exact answer you wanted gave you something else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it can be tricky, especially when we look at other people and say, well, you should be happy with your lot in life. That's like the reverse of, here, let me fix everything by performing eye surgery on you before I remove the logs from my own eyes. No unauthorized eye surgery. Let's move on to saying 17. Sue, would you like to read for us?
Jesus said, I will give you that which no eye has seen, no ear has heard, no hand has touched, and no human heart has conceived.
All right, let's let that sink in for a moment or two in silence. What do you make of saying 17?
Well, I'm thinking that when he gives us all these things, we should be in a kingdom of heaven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
So this
Sue,
one,
Marilyn? Go on.
It seems to me he's also saying that I'm giving you something that nobody has ever really had on earth without me or God in life. And we often overlook that. I think that's part of contentment. It doesn't mean, oh, I'm going to be perfectly happy with just whatever I have. It means I'm not going to be, I don't even know how to define it except to say not overly dissatisfied or something, but I'm not going to say, well, what I have is plenty even or whatever. It's a different kind of satisfaction, for lack of a better word, but that's what I want to say.
Yeah. Sue, what are your thoughts?
It's hard to be grateful for a gift you can't imagine. I mean, not that you won't be, and perhaps it's already, you know, apparent in your life, and you are grateful for it. It's just that you couldn't imagine it.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably different for everyone, too. Not necessarily everyone, but from person to person, that kind of peace that he's giving is different for you than it is for me. Mm-hmm. Maybe, I don't know, because I'm not sure what it means exactly.
Because right. We can't imagine it.
I really like the tack that Grace was on too. You know, Grace said, you know, this would happen in the kingdom of God. And I would turn that around and say, what if this is the kingdom of God? You know, the kingdom of God that is like a mustard seed, and the kingdom of God that is like the pearl beyond price, and the kingdom of God that is like the woman who searches for the lost coin. And it's like all of these things. And if the kingdom of God was something that you had seen, or your ear had heard, or your hand had touched, or your human heart had conceived, Jesus might not have to say what it was like all the time, because you've never actually experienced it, or at least we can't remember experiencing it. And so Jesus tells us what it is like-ish, but it's not a woman looking for a coin. And it's not actually a mustard bush, but it's like that.
But it's probably different for different people.
And so perhaps saying 17 is Jesus yet again trying to tell us that we will have the kingdom of heaven. And whatever it is you think it is, you're wrong, because you're not quite there. It might be close to that, but not exactly. Not exactly. Grace, do you feel up to reading saying 18 for us?
Sure, I would.
Great.
The disciples said to Jesus, "Tell us how our end will be." Jesus replied, "Have you discovered the beginning so that you look for the end? For where the beginning is, there will be the end. Blessed is he who will take his place in the beginning. He will know the end and will have no taste death."
All right. Let's let that beautiful conundrum sit in for a moment or two of silence. What are your opinions on saying 18?
Sounds like the beginning of John's gospel.
Good observation.
I think it's like the door that we see through darkly, and we won't know what it feels like until we see, you know.
I think you're referring to the mirror. The mirror we see through darkly.
Yeah, right.
Yep. And then we will see clearly. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about the beginning is where the end is, that's a circle. And so life and existence, evolution, all the things that we do know that are circular begin and end in the same place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm not sure what that proves, but...
And the reason that's hard is because we can't imagine a place where there is not a beginning and an end. We need the line, and we're not going to have that line. But we just can't visualize anything that doesn't have either an end or a beginning.
Right.
We're linear, and he's speaking in circles.
Even if you're in a circle, you have to have one spot, which is, this is where the end is, and this is where the beginning is, even if it's this big, but you can't have that.
Mm-hmm. You guys, you're mentioning all of the good bits, you know? So well done, philosophers. Well done.
Confused.
You know, but that's what philosophy is. Mm-hmm. Taking the confusion and breaking it apart and trying to make it less confused. And so, you know, it is so easy for us to view our lives in a linear fashion because we're stuck in time. Time makes our perception linear. There was the stuff that came before and the stuff that came before that. And there's where we seem to be now traveling into the future that we can only speculate on. And from that speculation comes the question, what will be our end? The end of this linear road we're traveling. And Jesus says, apparently, it's not linear. You want to know your end, but you don't even know your beginning. And so that makes me wonder, like, is he talking about birth? Is he talking about conception? Is he talking about those earliest years of our lives that we don't remember clearly? Or is he talking about something else? And given that it's Jesus, it's probably something else. Because, you know, that just seems to be the way he rolls. And so then that makes me think of beginning in God. And if we began in God, which theologically, I suspect we did, and we are having this dreamlike experience of a linear life. But if saying 18 guides us, our beginning will be our end. And so we will return to God, and it will suddenly seem like a circle and not a line. And it makes me think of a circle that is large enough to seem like a line, which, you know, would be planetary in size. And if we could just keep going in a straight line on the planet, we would eventually come back to the place we began. And we would have an experience of walking a straight line. And yet we would end up where we began. And it's a conundrum if you don't see that you're actually on a gigantic planet.
Which requires you to believe in life after death, because mm-hmm. the linear part is life on Earth and the circular part is ending where you began, which means there is something after that, or there wouldn't be the ongoing circle.
Right.
And so you will not taste death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so does that mean that the not tasting death, that we're going to live in this linear line forever? Maybe that's not quite what he meant.
No.
Maybe it's, you know, the anguish and fear of dying. And having been at a lot of bedsides, and serving as a chaplain, I've seen a bunch of people die. Some of them didn't seem to taste death. And others, it was all they could taste.
So believing in circular motion implies that this is just a temporary, you're on the straight short path of a very long circular journey that doesn't end.
Yeah.
One of the definitions of death is simply separation from God, and to say for someone who never will experience that separation, they never taste death.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah. And, you know, St. Paul, in one of his letters, I apologize that I can't tell you which one, talks about die to death now, die to death early. so that when it is your time, there's no pain, there's no fear. You don't taste death. And I think that's probably a really hard sell. Not that our religion should be easy, of course. But the fear of death is the most basic fear that human beings have. It's nice to know that we might be able to get beyond it, though.
Isn't that, when you think about it, a bit egotistical? We can't imagine that we won't exist.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we can't imagine that people can get on without us.
Yeah. And yet, you know, grief is real.
Yes, yes, it is.
Grief is real, and it is not unchristian to grieve.
But that's the other side of the coin. That's missing someone that was important to you. It's not that you're not going to exist without them. It's just that they have a lot of learning to go through to even out the bumps in the road.
You know, and sometimes I wonder in our grief, and this might be getting a little too crazy theological for you. So if it doesn't fit, just throw it out. But I sometimes wonder in all the things that we grieve for, from the death of the person closest to us, to the death of a relationship, to the death of, you know, the smaller deaths in our lives, the death of living in a place, the death of our independence, you know, all these smaller deaths, as well as the really big ones. I sometimes wonder if in those moments, what really is happening is that we have ripped the cover off of the seething cauldron of pain that is always inside of us, that we feel in the separation from God, in not actually being right now in heaven with God, and that that is a constant source of pain that we do everything we can to cover up, and that remains largely unconscious and deeply unconscious. And then when someone else is ripped away from us, someone we love, someone we care for, a situation we wanted to just continue on, that it doesn't kind of rip the scab off of that wound. And we're feeling the deep loss and pain and separation from our spouse's death or our child's death or our mother's death or our father's death. But we're also feeling the deep well of grief we've always carried from not being arm in arm with God all the time. Food for thought.
Yeah, it is. I have often wondered if babies don't cry when they're born because they never wanted to leave the womb. They didn't ask for this, but mom pushed them out.
Yes.
Sort of like the birds knocking them out of the nest.
Mm-hmm. I had a particularly colicky nephew. And Lord above, that child could scream. Oh, he could scream. And I was one of the few people who could calm him down. But of course, you have to keep walking with him. You have to constantly just keep walking and rocking. And I thought a lot about those exact questions, Sue. As I was walking and rocking with my colicky nephew, who, you know, is now graduating from college. So, you know, he got over it. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I was with my mother, my brother, and my father when they died.
Okay.
And they, all three of them were very painful. They were all very stick and paint. And so it was like, I was happy when they took their last breath. I still mourned them, but I was happy that God had taken them and took the pain away.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I've, one of my very favorite parishioners died during COVID. And that's what everybody struggled with, because her death wasn't particularly painful, but she lived in tremendous pain for like the last 10 years of her life, just constant physical pain and then constant bouts of cancer. Like she just get well and then she'd get sick again. And, you know, sometimes it's easy to feel guilty because you're glad they're dead. It's like, well, I don't want them to be dead. I love them. I miss them. But I'm really glad that they're finally dead, because they were in so much pain. And, you know, for this particular person, nothing helped. Nothing that the doctors did helped to alleviate her constant chronic pain. And, you know, I had some good conversations with her husband, who was a retired pastor, about the relief and also the lingering guilt and the grief and the sadness. But overarching is this sense of relief. Like, thank God they're not suffering in that way anymore. Because sometimes our lives just devolve into suffering. And then death seems like a blessing.
And it is.
And on that uplifting note, it is just past 11, friends. And so we're going to wrap it up. I'm sorry we couldn't have ended on a slightly happier note, but you know, that's what we got. Mm-hmm. Thank you for joining me today. I will see you next week. And I hope that everyone has an excellent week in the interim.
You too.
And you too.
Bye, everybody. Be well.
Bye. Bye.